Welcome back to University of Minnesota Extension's Nutrient Management Podcast. I'm your guest host, Maggie Frazier, Communications Specialist here at U of M Extension. Today on the podcast, we're talking about sulfur. We have three members of Extension's Nutrient Management Team, Fabian Fernandez, Dan Kaiser, and Jeff Vetch, to cover the basics and beyond. Welcome. How about you each give us a quick introduction?
Sure. I'm Fabian Fernandez at the University of Minnesota Extension and Research. I work primarily on nitrogen management for corn cropping systems. And I've been here at the university now for five years. Hard to believe.
I'm Jeff Vetch. I'm a researcher at the Southern Research and Outreach Center in Waseca. Work in soil fertility, primarily in nitrogen management of corn, and I've actually been at that position for over 25 years.
So this is Dan Kaiser. I'm a nutrient management specialist at the University of Minnesota. I spend a lot of time working with fertilizer guidelines, and one of the major areas of emphasis I've had in the past 10 years since I've been here has been on sulfur management in corn, soybean, and spring wheat.
All right. Can you talk a little about some of your first encounters with sulfur deficiency in corn in medium and fine textured soils?
Yeah. So, you know, we first kind of started noticing that there was something going on primarily from a research standpoint in the early 2000s. But prior to that, in the 90s, when we did a lot of manure research, we would always compare nitrogen fertilizer nitrogen rates to manure nitrogen rates, focusing on nitrogen, of course. But the manure frequently on these medium and fine textured higher organic matter soils would have a darker green color, it would have higher SPAD readings when we did chlorophyll meter readings, and often would have a higher yield. And we never quite could put a finger on it. We always kind of called it the manure effect. But looking back, I really think some of that was sulfur nutrition, and that sometimes we got a yield response to sulfur in some of those fields, and sometimes we didn't. When we finally started identifying sulfur as the nutrient was in a lime study that we did at Waseca on a nickelate soil that had about 4.5% organic matter. And that study ran from 1999 through 2006. And we had 6 years of corn, 5 years of alfalfa. And only 3 of the 6 years of corn did we get a significant yield response to sulfur. And in one of those 6 years, it was greater than 10 bushels. But again, we saw the same kind of physical plant health where very early in the season when that corn was from V6 to V8, the treatments that got sulfur had darker green color, more biomass, looked healthier, and that was kind of when it really started opening our eyes. In alfalfa, we only had 1 of 5 site years, but there was no with lime and with sulfur treatments. So wherever we put sulfur in our alfalfa studies, they actually were pH deficient. So I think we needed the synergy of those two things together to see a better yield response. Then the next study that we looked at was a starter fertilizer study that had both N, P, K, and S in different combinations at different rates. And that was really the big eye-opener where we saw an average 8 bushel yield response over the 3 years. And in 2006, in our study that was corn on corn, we had a 20 bushel yield response to just 4 pounds of sulfur. And that was really kind of that earth, you know, eye awakening moment where this is a nutrient that we really need to pay attention to.
Yeah. And when I came here in Minnesota, I started in 2007. I was at Iowa State before that. And just out of Northeast Iowa, there, Brian Lang, one of their fields crop specialists up there. I know him and working with John Sawyer out of a campus, they were looking at sulfur around the Decorah area and some of the rolling, kind of the lust soils up in that area, seeing a lot of responses. So that's kind of the first time that I had been aware of it. And then when I started in Minnesota, I had a few consultants kind of in my ear in terms of some issues we were seeing. So then we started some strip trials looking at N, P, and S for both corn and soybean production. And the corn years, I mean, particularly 2009 when we had that really cool year, that was a year that the site we were on, we had a pretty rolling topography and really low organic matters. And there was some huge responses, like 60, 70 bushels at that particular location. And it's been interesting because year does make an impact because we got into 2011 and 12. We had some really good years. And then 11 and 12, really then we started to see a little bit drier conditions and the responses weren't quite as much. But the last 2 years, I mean, with the wet conditions we've had, particularly in, like Jeff was saying, what surprised me is the area around Waseca there. I expected maybe the southeastern part of the state, some of those silt loam soils to respond, but we've been seeing pretty consistent responses in these higher organic matter, poorly drained soils, particularly in corn-on-corn systems.
Yeah, and for me, I came from the University of Illinois. I was a faculty member there. And it was similar to what Jeff and Dan mentioned, that it was in those early 2000s that people started looking at that, starting to see issues. And that was no different in Illinois. There were consultants and farmers that talked to me about it. And so we decided to do a study. We had done, as a university, before I arrived there, there had been some other studies in the 80s, and there was very little response, and so I was a little suspicious if, you know, what was going on, and sure enough, we did the study, and we found that there were locations where it was, we obtained some response. In some locations, as particular sandy soil, which there are not that many of those in Illinois, but we actually got over a 50 bushel yield increase with sulfur in there. Was just strikingly different compared to the no sulfur treatments. And the other part that was interesting was that not all the soils that responded were the coarse textures or light texture soils. There were some pretty good high organic matter soils that also responded to sulfur, and that was an interesting thing. And I think part of why we are seeing these things is that with the cleaner air, we don't get as much sulfur deposition. We used to, if you look at maps of sulfur deposition across the Midwest, we were getting anywhere from 20 or more pounds per acre per year deposited from the atmosphere, so basically free sulfur fertilizer for our crops, and that has really dwindled to almost nothing now, as some of the regulations have cleared the air from power plants and things like that. And so I think a lot of what we are seeing now is the fact that we are not getting that free sulfur from the atmosphere.
Yeah, and I mean, legacy does have a big impact, particularly previous applications. As Fabian was saying, some of those just repeated applications year after year from the air. I think looking at that over time, I mean, as Jeff was saying, it was interesting, you know, Jeff mentioning kind of some of that stuff in the 80s, seeing that as I think you saw those trends of the atmospheric deposition go down, I mean, it does make sense. You start looking at that and those additions starting to dwindle more and more, where it just starts to become more and more deficient as we start increasing our yields and putting a little bit high, greater demand, although we know that, I mean, demand hasn't changed greatly with sulfur. I mean, we're still looking at about 25 pounds in corn production being what's taken up on an annual basis, maybe up to 30, kind of depends
on. And usually things, around a 10-pound removal or somewhere in that neighborhood.
So, I mean, that's one of the things I think in terms of finding sites. You know, back in about 11 and 12, I was wondering if I was able to find a responsive site again, because most of the growers have already took to the information that we were showing and started applying. And then we're seeing just the levels that we're carrying over in the soil start to increase again, because we're starting to get to levels that were additions like we were seeing with some of that acid rainfall. So it got to a point at which we weren't really seeing a whole lot, but then we've been getting into kind of a wetter cycle now, and I think we're seeing some more of that start to drop down, and, you know, some of it could be source as well. I mean, we know that elemental has some issues with oxidation. That's a lot, some of the growers are applying that, so there may be still some issues there, but it's been interesting. I said it's been a roller coaster a little bit in terms of responsiveness, and really depends on the year. Cool, wet years tend to see greater potential, particularly since I think a lot of our troubles come early in the growing season. I mean, we only need roughly about 10% of the total uptake by about V6, but that's a critical period for us where we have some soils that crop can't get it out of those soils.
Yeah, and you know, Jeff mentioned the effect of manure, and I think, you know, when you think about deposition, having less deposition, and legacy of manure, you know, we don't have as much manure applications as a whole in the state as maybe we had in decades earlier. Excuse me. And then fertilizers also have become more clean. They used to have more impurities with sulfur, and we don't have as much of that. So all of that combined, I think, has resulted in what we are seeing more commonly now with responses to sulfur. One thing, though, that I would mention is that with sulfur, it's important to really see if you are getting a response to sulfur or not. You don't have to go and apply sulfur in every acre just in case, because you will see the deficiencies, and it will be clear that they are there. If if you don't see those deficiencies and you're curious, you can, you know, do a trial, just see if you get that response. But it doesn't mean that you will see responses everywhere all the time.
And I see some of the current genetics sometimes will have a tendency to stripe. I'm not too concerned about it if it's just the upper leaves. So that one leaf on the top that you see some faint striping on. You start getting below that and you start to see it real striking, that yellow interveinal striping on it, then it's likely going to be more of an issue. But I've seen that where we've applied sulfur even at 25 pounds where we still see some of that striping. I think it's just the crop is can't meet the demand as fast as it's growing early on. So it has a little bit of a tendency to show some faint if you look at interveinal striping, but it isn't anything that's really clearly visible unless you really look at it.
And there's definitely, you know, crop interactions with sulfur fertility. And first off, you know, we talk primarily about corn, and that's the key one. But also thinking of forages demand for sulfur. And then when you get to the small grains, it seems like it's just it's more of a hit or miss of whether you're going to see a response to sulfur in small grains.
Yeah, and that you mentioned, you know, the early part of the growing season, and I think that's kind of where I would make sure that I look at the crop closely during that early part of the growing season. And if you see some striping developing, that may be an indication that, okay, maybe I should dig a little deeper and see if this is really a problem or if it's just a reason of the season. You know, if it's a wet, cool season, you may get some deficiency, but it will be a temporary thing that the plants will come out of it once it warms up and you start getting mineralization from that soil. But that would be kind of the first step in deciding, you know, do I need sulfur? Well, if you see those stripes early on, it may be telling you that you're getting close to needing to apply sulfur.
What have you found when comparing fall and spring application of sulfur?
You know, I think it gets back to, Dan, what you mentioned earlier about the kind of climatic interactions you have in the spring. And I think that some of our inconsistent performance of some of these fall applications are really driven a little bit by the spring weather as well and the kind of crop or year it's going to be. If it stays wet and cool in the spring, the sulfate sources are so important, and it's probably best if they're applied in the spring. If you're using something like Elemental in the fall, I've had years in our trials where it did just fine, and I've had years where it didn't do fine. And I think it gets back to that kind of a climate for sulfur. Is it going to be a year when there's going to be a demand and a lot of deficiency, or is it a year when it doesn't take that much and then Elemental will do just fine?
I think it really depends on rate and how much you're applying. And if you're really going kind of with our recommended rates, they're mainly, I think, based around what I would consider to be a spring application, particularly on the lighter end of the recommended ranges. So you have to be somewhat careful because we know we're probably going to move some sulfur. The sulfate, if you look in the soil, doesn't move quite as quickly as nitrate. So I'm really not concerned about it being completely leached out of the root zone, but there's still some risk there. And the last couple of years, I've had some fall spring trials. And the two sites that we had responses at, the one was on a silt loam in the southeast. That one definitely favored spring application. And that was would have been applying in the fall of 2016 for a 2017 crop. And we had a lot of rainfall. So that kind of made sense with that one. Then we had one last year at Waseca that responded. And then the fall spring, it really didn't seem to matter. So that's one of the things that, I mean, really the leaching potential, it's there. I've seen actually where I can make a one-year application. I see some of that sulfur, I don't know how much, but some of it carried over for more than 1 year, that they're more than one crop more than 1 year out of application is still picking it up. So, I mean, it really depends. I mean, it depends a lot on application, and that's one of the things that I know a lot of growers are concerned about with it, particularly if they want to put it in with the P&K. If they're not doing any broadcast applications in the spring, they don't really have another option to put sulfur on.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Dan. If you're putting on 20 or 25 pounds per acre for corn in a corn bean rotation, it probably doesn't matter when you put it on. I think when it matters is when you start reducing some of these rates down under 10 pounds, then the timing and the place or the source is probably more important.
The other thing too, which could relate a little bit to the fall versus spring application, is the crop rotation and the type of tillage that you have. You know, the soils that will be more propense to be deficient early in the spring will be soils where you have continuous corn or minimum tillage, where you have a lot of crop residue. Those soils tend to stay cooler and wetter. And in those situations, spring application may be better because you need to have something that is readily available. And fall applications, again, if you're using something more like an elemental form, may not mineralize fast enough for that situation.
Yeah, well, I mean, the oxidation potential, I mean, was, you look at how cold we are, right? Even with the fall application, unless you're putting on in September, you're probably not going to get much oxidation of those products with an elemental sulfur product. So that's been kind of my question. I've seen that years, I think it was 2011, we had some studies looking at zinc where we applied sulfur, just blanket applied it, and it was an area where it's primarily, I think, a fall elemental, and you could see my plots, there's green little postage stamps out in the middle of the field, and it got a little stir within that neighborhood of where we're at. It was around the Grand Meadow area, and there was some supplemental sulfur that went on at that point in time just because it just wasn't available. So, I mean, that oxidation, it takes a higher temperature, so it takes more to oxidize elemental than, you know, when we usually would see early in the growing season. So that's kind of that balance, I think, between the two, I think, becomes important to having a little bit of sulfate earlier, at least getting some oxidized elemental, that sulfate that's oxidized out of that carried over to the next year is really important to make sure that works.
Yeah, and those oxidation things, you know, situations where the oxidation is not rapid is also the same situations where you have very slow mineralization of sulfur, so you have kind of both working against you. The plant just doesn't get enough.
And you can actually end up with immobilization. And Dan, I think he had some grad student that looked at that, where you can drive immobilization of sulfur in the right conditions.
What is the best source of sulfur to use for corn?
Well, I think we covered some of this. I think some of it depends on timing. You know, I do prefer sulfate if I can get it. Elemental, if there's just that question mark of oxidation potential. The other issue with elemental, particularly products like Tiger 9, year distribution, and that's one of the things with low rates, I think we consistently run into, when I've compared them, say at 5 and 15 pounds, which kind of around a little bit less and more than what we recommend, is you look at how those granules are distributed on the soil surface, and there's a lot of space between particularly 90% product versus these other products, which may be 15-20% sulfur. So that's an issue I think you run into with elemental. I mean, that's why I'd probably not go more than less than 25 pounds with elemental product, maybe even more if you're getting such low oxidation. But then again, when you look at the overall cost, elemental's been cheaper and you start increasing the rate, then you're probably about a wash in terms of the two, in terms of a price. So, I mean, that's the main thing. Liquids, actually, ammonium thiosulfate, I think, is a good option with that product. Actually, if you look at it, how the thiosulfate ion is built, it has some elemental when it dissociates, and it'll have sulfate. So you will get some of that extended potential release with that immediately available. So that product or some of these microessential lines where you have kind of a blend of the two, I think would work well because you get that immediate availability. So for short early on, and then you get some release later that, you know, probably isn't going to help us as much, but maybe it's available for further years if that oxidation is sulfate can be carried over.
Yeah, I think the source is just what you said, Dan. It kind of goes with the farmer preference too. If they want to apply with their broadcast in the fall, then elemental is probably a good option because it's inexpensive, but they're going to probably need a higher rate. And maybe they want to consider a small amount of ATS or thiosulfate at planting. If they're going to go across the field in the spring with some application, whether it's urea or something other, it just seems logical to use AMS and blend it in with that urea during that pre-plant application. You really can't go wrong in that situation. And we see a lot of ATS going on with the planter in a dribble band, and I think they like how that responds, or that crop, especially in corn on corn, how that plant can respond to those treatments. And we also hear a lot of stories about people that are side dressing with liquid 28% or 32% that are including some ATS in with that, just to make sure that they have kind of season-long sulfur availability.
Yeah, and with it, I mean, one thing about AMS that my only drawback essentially would be the acidification. So you have to be careful with high rates because we do know that it will acidify faster. I mean, as a nitrogen source, it tends to do that. So if you're already dealing with kind of marginally low pHs, I mean, you may see a need for lime a little bit quicker if you're putting on a high rate of AMS. Gypsum's out there. That's the solubility can vary of that product. But, you know, overall, we've seen it does tend to work very well for supplying sulfur. I mean, some of the other products like K-Mag, Sulpomag, or potassium sulfate. I mean, the cost is a little bit higher when you start looking at those, so you're probably more dedicated into the specialty market for some of those with higher value crops.
Yeah, with ammonium sulfate, it is a great source for both sulfur and nitrogen. But as Dan mentioned, the acidification is more acidifying nitrogen source that we have. But it does work well in situations maybe towards the western part of the state where you have more alkaline conditions, or in places where you are not able to incorporate the fertilizer. If you're going to leave it on the surface, you know, ammonium sulfate is a much, much better source than urea, even with a urease inhibitor, because you are avoiding the volatilization losses that you would have with urea.
And with sulfur, we don't have that volatility. And that's one of the questions I get, is if I leave it on the surface, will I lose sulfur? And we don't get that. So with those immediately soluble sources, it does tend to work better. And with the application of the surface applications, too, I've heard that actually the Tiger 90 rep was suggesting putting that product on to get it to fracture better, because that's one of the issues with elemental is it's hydrophobic. So if you get it into the soil, it doesn't really dissolve very well. It can kind of clump back together as some of that bentonite is releasing. So I've been some things with there. I mean, I just, you know, in terms of availability, if you want immediately available, you've got to look at some sort of sulfate source.
There's talk about interactions between nitrogen and sulfur. Should farmers be concerned about this interaction?
Well, one of the things I commonly see, and you know, in some of our studies, if we are marginally deficient in nitrogen, we have sulfur studies. Typically, I don't get those real striking sulfur deficiencies because the plant goes nitrogen deficient. And that's one of the things that we know there's a linkage between the two. I've done some studies looking at it to see whether or not sulfur changes my optimum N rate, and that's never been conclusive that that effect is there, but it tends to see some bigger impact with the sulfur itself with that. It's so you can see some, if you've got nitrogen deficiency, typically you're probably not going to see any impact of the sulfur, but again, we know these two can interact, and we can see some things that kind of occur just based on the two. And corn on corn particularly, as Jeff said, ATS, you look at early availability of nutrients, sulfur and nitrogen are going to be two of the big ones that we're going to see problems with in corn on corn because of immobilization with those. So, you know, having those two together can be some benefit, particularly early on with corn on corn, to at least get the crop going and get a more even green stand.
Yeah, Dan, you know, I showed those pictures when I used to do presentations around the state of, you know, we have 100% greater dry matter accumulation in high residue corn on corn situations, where we put a small band of nitrogen and sulfur near the corn row. And that just really stands out. Now, does that always result in a significantly large or yield increase or a profitable yield increase? No, but certainly when you see that kind of better plant growth and plant health and uniformity, that certainly opens growers' eyes.
Yeah, and with, again, a lot of the issues with sulfur tend to have, especially if you're kind of borderline there between sufficiency and deficiency, they tend to happen during stressful springs when it's cool, wet, and it is pretty difficult sometimes to tease those apart because the plants are stressed, and so you see, you know, pale plants, and it's pretty hard sometimes to determine, is that nitrogen, is it sulfur? And so that's, again, those are the situations where I would say it's important to start maybe digging a little deeper and seeing, okay, is this a real problem with one or two of those nutrients?
And it's one of the things, too, with a lot of these products, you just see a lot of these products contain both nitrogen and sulfur. I mean, one of the ones we didn't talk about in the last, talking about sources, was these microessentials lines. And I don't know if the efficiency-wise, if it really makes it more efficient for having the two nutrients together, other than, I mean, essentially these products are more for the evenness of spread. So you're getting a little bit of sulfur in every granule, so you're spreading out the elemental a little bit better than you would with a product like Tiger 90. So that helps with that, and then you said you've got some of that availability. So these are mainly just more for suited better just for having a one product that can supply more than one nutrient, that you'd only have to look at one product instead of multiples and a blend of a fertilizer itself.
And the important thing with, you know, with products like that where you incorporate different nutrients, you know, MES or MESZ, where you have also zinc, you know, it's like, do you really need that? Those are important things to consider when making those decisions. In my experience, again, going back to the work that I did in Illinois, whenever we had a response to sulfur, it didn't really matter which source we were looking at. The response was pretty similar across the different sources. And then where there was no response, of course, it didn't matter either, right? But so again, as a sulfur source, it can work very well. I think this being able to spread it uniformly is probably the biggest advantage. And then if you really need some of the other nutrients that come with it, then it may be a good option as well.
One thing we haven't talked that much about is rates. And I know in some of our early work, we got by in our high organic matter glacial till soils with some really low rates. But that's probably the question that I get the most. And I see a lot of dealers and a lot of farmers that are applying 20 to 25 pounds of actual sulfur per acre, whether it's an elemental or whether it's a sulfate source. And in corn after soybean, I just don't think on our higher organic matter soils, those higher rates are needed. But maybe on some of the lower organic matter soils, when you get in those eroded knolls and the rolling topography that we see in the plains or in the morainal plains of the till and also in southeast Minnesota, those higher rates might be justified, especially in corn on corn.
Well, even in a corn-soybean rotation, because I haven't really been recommending any application right ahead of the beans, and if you put 20 to 25 pounds on, I mean, I've seen consistently where you've seen increases in bean yield on some of those real eroded areas that would be low in sulfur. And we don't get some of the issues with vegetative growth, which we typically, with beans, it tends to increase vegetative growth, which isn't a good idea for that crop because it tends to take away from seed production. So, I mean, that's one of the things with rate. A lot of times what I've been seeing essentially currently has been about 5 pounds. But some of that I've been looking at, and Fabian mentioned this earlier, with sulfur impurities in some of the fertilizers, there's still some in there. I mean, we've been measuring anywhere from 1% to 2% total S in some of the MAP and DAPs in the triple superphosphate sources. And kind of when I looked at that, it was about maybe 5 pounds of total S going on, which you look at the crop, it actually seems like I can actually see that in some of these sites with that. So that may be why we only take a low rate. I mean, 10 pounds really goes a long way. And then if you're banning, I think 2 to 3 gallons of ATS really is probably about, you know, kind of that sweet spot. But again, it just depends on when you're applying and what source, because if it's an elemental source, I definitely would go higher than that.
Oh, I agree with you, Dan. I think that the little bit that's in MAP and DAP and some of those things really makes a difference, because we see it's so commonplace today that growers that are in a corn bean rotation might be putting on 150 or 200 pounds of DAP biennially. And if they're putting that out there right before corn, that's a fair amount of sulfur that they're applying as well. Now, it might not all be available immediately from those sources, but it certainly could be counted, even though it isn't on the label. Now, obviously, with MES or MES, it's right on the label and it's proven.
All right, that does it for the podcast this week. We'd like to thank the Minnesota Agricultural Fertilizer Research and Education Council, AFREC, for supporting this podcast. For the latest information on nutrient management, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at UMN Nutrient MGMT, where you can also send us your questions for future podcast episodes. Thanks for listening.